I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The West Philadelphia neighborhood where our guest Kareem Rosser grew up is about as far as you can get from the privileged, elite, and nearly all-white world of polo that's been called the sport of kings. He writes in his new memoir, Crossing the Line, about how he and his brothers, riding their bikes in Fairmount Park, found a barn full of horses, and the Work to Ride program run by Leslie Heiner, who was a guest on Radio Times a number of years ago. That was the start of Kareem Rosser's love affair with horses, with riding, and eventually with polo. He writes about the safety he felt in the barn that would ease his fears, even his panic attacks. He later went on to lead his Colorado State University polo team to a national championship and was named Intercollegiate Polo Player of the Year. Now, you might have seen him in a Polo Ralph Lauren ad or on a mural in his neighborhood. He was Idris Elba's stunt double in the forthcoming film Concrete Cowboys that was filmed in Philadelphia. And he joins us on Radio Times. Kareem Rosser, thanks for writing the book and thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
No, thank you, Marty. I'm thrilled to be here. I've been listening to you for many years. As I detailed in my book, you know, I spent a lot of time in the car with Leslie listening to NPR, so I know your voice very well.
Well, I really appreciate that. And she's quite something. And we will talk about her, of course. How much do you still have time or even play polo?
I still try to find a time to play when I get an opportunity to, but definitely not as much as I, you know, not as much time as I had in the past, just because, you know, life is now quite busy and I'm very involved with my day job and working at an asset management firm. But still, you know, I get an opportunity to visit Leslie and the kids as often as I can. And, you know, I also serve on the board of the organization as well.
Tell me why you wrote this book, and I should say, and we'll get into some of the things that you write about your neighborhood, your childhood, your parents, but did you write it for yourself? Did you write it for kids kind of like yourself, maybe growing up in West Philly?
Yeah, it's a bit of everything, you know. So, you know, as you mentioned, our story's been covered, you know, for the last couple of decades, and, you know, fortunately, you know, we've been on many national media outlets and Sports Illustrated, ESPN, 60 Minutes. And each time, you know, they're only able to tell bits and pieces of the story and, you know, and what Leslie has done over the last couple of decades and, you know, and how she has transformed lives here in Philadelphia. And, you know, I thought it was important to tell the entire story, to not just give bits and pieces of it, because, you know, I was hoping that by telling this story that, you know, it would inspire a generation of people, but also, you know, give, you know, kind of looking back on it as well and wanting to inspire kids who grew up where we grew up, but, you know, letting people know that, you know, with a little bit of hard work that you have an opportunity to succeed.
You grew up in a part of West Philadelphia that you call the bottom, Viola Street. Describe it for our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom, the name describes itself, I think, pretty well. You know, it's one of the worst neighborhoods, I think arguably one of the worst neighborhoods in Philadelphia. You know, I grew up on Viola Street, you know, not too far from the Please Touch Museum here in Philadelphia. And, you know, each day for us, we kind of, you know, we woke up not knowing, you know, if, you know, someone's going to get killed or if we're going to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, we you know, including ourselves and including other families, you know, we struggled each day. And you know, the neighborhood was just filled with just a lot of violence and crime. And you know, just it was, you know, it was a daily struggle for everyone who lived in the neighborhood.
You write about your family, your mother. She was a young mother. I think she had your older brother, David, when she was something like 14 years old. You know, a hardworking person. You do not sugarcoat this portrait of your mother at all.
Yeah, no. I mean, my mom, you know, is one of the you know, hardest working women that I know. And, you know, and what she has been through, you know, throughout the course of her life is it's incredible. To watch how, you know, how she perseveres every day. You know, she's, you know, she is a single mom who raised six kids by herself. She had six of us before she was 30. You know, we grew up on welfare. You know, she struggled, you know, with her own, you know, she battled, you know, with her own addiction issues and a lot of it had to do with just the loss that she dealt with, you know, throughout her life. And, you know, and it was a very common thing where we grew up, you know, families, would cope with their loss and their struggles by, you know, turning to drugs. And my mom, unfortunately, was one of those individuals.
Yeah, you called her in certain ways a functional alcoholic. So she was able to be a mom, although it sounds like there were times she disappeared. There were times that even when she was home, it wasn't like she was there with you, you know, psychologically or emotionally.
Yeah, no, you know, my mom was, you know, she was absent in many ways. Sometimes when she was physically there, she was just absent because she was, you know, she was high or she was drinking, you know. And so as a young kid, you know, I would see that all the time. And my siblings, we would always see, you know, my mom just struggling and then also trying to, you know, feed six kids. That's not easy. I think even if, you know, you have the means to do it, it's still a very difficult thing for one person to take on. And but fortunately, you know, my grandparents were around, you know, up until they passed away. But, you know, my mom just, you know, she was just struggling each day and she dealt with it by, you know, by using.
Yeah. You describe kind of two kind of parents that you were aware of. There were the ones that never let their children out of their sight. They protected them, you know, walked them to school, kept them inside so that they were not in any kind of danger. And your mom basically kind of opened the door and let you kids out into the world.
Yeah, no, exactly. You know, so, you know, I detail in my memoir, you know, just as you noted, you know, how you have families where we grew up who either, you know, they spend a lot of time trying to protect their kids just from the violence and the drugs and, you know, and having sex at an early age. And then you have some parents who just kind of open the door and let their kids run wild. You know, my mom did a very good job at protecting us. And, you know, we did have some rules despite, you know, kind of doing whatever we wanted to do. But my mom realized that, you know, we were going to have to figure out how to survive. You know, she could only do so much for us. Rather than, you know, trying to shelter us and protect us from the inevitable, which was, you know, facing, you know, a group of people and protecting ourselves from, you know, getting jumped or beat up or being in the wrong place at the wrong time where you never know, you know, someone decides to open fire and shooting at someone. How do we manage and deal with those situations? And then also, you know, kind of, you know, having people, you know, walk up to us and offer us drugs and or offering us opportunities to sell drugs and how to say no or how to get out of those situations. It was important for my mom to expose us to that. And I'm grateful today that, you know, I was able to see those things at an early age because I think, you know, it allowed for me to figure out how to problem solve at an early age as well.
And I do want to get to the riding and the stable and the horses, all that. But just another thing that you write about yourself, and this comes up a number of times, is that you were a fearful kid, and you even describe yourself as a fearful kid living with a bunch of daredevils, and that would be your siblings, of course.
Yeah, no, I was definitely very timid, and you know, I spent a lot of time watching. I would always observe, and you know, I was that kid who would. You know, I would rather my brothers get in trouble before I got in trouble than I would learn from their mistakes. But then at the same time, you know, I didn't want to go to jail. You know, I saw people get arrested, or you know, I didn't want to go get beat up by a group of people. You know, and so I kind of sat back and watched my older brothers who, at times, really, you know, as you know, they're just fearful. You know, they were fearless, and you know, they would just kind of go on and take on anything. You know, unfortunately, you know, I had them there to protect me, but at the same time, I always looked up to them too. You know, they were an inspiration to me, and at one point I wanted to be just like them.
Well, your two older brothers, David and Bea, they're on their bikes. They're in Fairmount Park in Philadelphia, and they, I don't know, round a corner, and there is a barn full of horses. And this, of course, is this introduction to the Work to Ride program and to Leslie Heiner. You kind of pushed your way in and, you know, it took you a while to get there. But once you got there, it just felt, at least the way you write, it was a kind of really, this is such a cliche, but love at first sight. I mean, you just felt like this is where I need to be.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so, you know, my one afternoon, my brothers, I want to say, you know, back in late 99, early 2000s, you know, they were out on their bikes riding in Fairmount Park, in West Fairmount Park, just near the Belmont Plateau, right, where the stable is located. You know, and they, like most people, and when Shariah will come on, I think she'll say the same. They accidentally just found this incredible place. And it's hard to articulate, because I think one has to go there to actually experience that feeling that we all felt at one point in understanding, you know, how it just transformed lives. And, you know, my first time there with my brothers, again, I was kind of sat back and watch and observe. You know, I was, you know, walking down the barn aisle and you know, looking at all these beautiful horses, but they were all massive. And I was just this little 8-year-old boy, you know, wondering if one of these horses is going to jump over the stall door and bite me. But, you know, I had my brothers there, and, you know, when I showed up there with them and I started watching them handle the horses and groom the horses and just their interaction with Leslie and all the other animals that were at the barn, you know, I was just incredibly excited, and I realized this was my home away from home.
Well, I love the way, and I've been in barns, and I know that smell when you describe that sweet smell of what it's like to be in a barn with horses.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a very distinct smell, and sometimes, you know, my mom didn't appreciate that smell when we would come home from the barn, certainly. You know, we would show up, we would, you know, leave the barn, you know, kind of our shoes are just, you know, filled with manure, you know, we have hay in our hair, you know, our clothes are just filthy. You know, my mom would yell at us right before we walked into the house, take those, you know, clothes off right now and at the front door before you walk in here. So she didn't appreciate that smell. But, you know, we certainly did, because, you know, we knew immediately that we were in a safe environment. That smell, you know, that smell was just so special to us, because we left home, we left a violent neighborhood in West Philly, and we were at a place that just made us all happy and feel free.
Kareem, we're almost up in a break here, but I mean, Leslie runs a very strict program in terms of riding, but also taking care of the horses, cleaning out the stalls. I mean, that explains, I guess, why you smell the way you did when you went home. But just a quick response to that, and then we'll take a very short break.
Yeah, no, Leslie, she runs a very tight ship even today. You know, she is an incredible woman who just has this ability to touch kids and families in a way that, you know, not many people can do. We showed up, you know, to the barn ready to work. You know, if we weren't working hard, we were not riding. You know, and she also, you know, made sure that we were doing well in school. You know, if we weren't doing well in school, we weren't riding. You know, so she ran a very, very, very tight ship, and, you know, and it produced some great kids.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Kareem Rosser. And we've been talking about this program that's in Fairmount Park in Philadelphia, the Work to Ride program run by Leslie Heiner. I mentioned the fact that she had been on the Radio Times program many, many years ago. He's got a new book. It's called Crossing the Line, and it's subtitled A Fearless Team of Brothers and the Sport That Changed Their Lives Forever, that sport being polo. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Growing up in West Philadelphia, Kareem Rosser wanted a way out of some of the poverty and violence that plagued his neighborhood. When he discovered with his brothers a barn of horses in Fairmount Park and a riding program, he found a passion for riding and eventually for polo. And that's what we're talking about. And that's what his book is about. It's called Crossing the Line. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Kareem, it's not unusual to see horses in West Philadelphia. I mean, they might not be playing polo as you do, but that's not an unusual sight. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, no, I think many people don't realize that Philadelphia has an incredible urban cowboy presence. You know, because I remember as a young boy, you know, before even joining Work to Ride, my siblings and I would see these black cowboys in Philly galloping up and down the streets in Philadelphia, And everyone, you know, we were like, where the heck are these horses? And, you know, we later learned that many people are keeping horses in their backyards in Philly.
Whoa.
You know, so you have guys who go and purchase horses at a nearby auction up in New Holland, Pennsylvania, and they would bring these horses back in, and they would just ride them throughout, you know, around the city. And it was incredible. So, you know, but as you mentioned, you know, these are all black cowboys, but none of them, you know, none of them know anything about polo and have no idea, you know, that, you know, we were at some point playing.
You describe, you know, being in the barn, getting close to these horses, being frightened because horses, even, you know, ponies, but even and certainly horses, they're big animals. Buck was the first horse that you rode. You fell off a lot. and then eventually you started riding a horse called Cholo. Tell us about Cholo.
Yeah, Cholo is one of my favorite and still is one of my favorite and an incredible horse. You know, so Cholo was given to me right before I went off to military school. Leslie, I had a good friend who had a talent for finding, you know, ex-race horses that we were able to convert into a polo pony. And Cholo was one of those horses. And the original idea was, you know, Leslie, you know, got Cholo for me and wanted me to train Cholo as a polo pony and then sell him and then use the proceeds to go towards my college tuition. Eventually, you know, I started working with Cholo and I fell in love with Cholo. And I told Les, there's no way we're selling this horse. We're keeping Cholo. We're going to have to figure out another way to fund my college tuition. And, you know, so Cholo, you know, I spent many years working with him. And, you know, he turned into this incredible polo pony. And he's been around for a very, very long time, and he's still is still an active horse, and, wow, and many kids are playing polo on him today.
You're right. Cholo was basically a Labrador retriever in a horse's body. He loved and trusted me from the moment I met him. I mean, that and the relationship between a rider and a horse is really something special.
Yeah, it is. You know, and Cholo, I had him during some of my darkest times when I was dealing with anxiety and going through, you know, quite a bit of personal issues. And, you know, when every time I would ride Cholo, you know, I would all those fears and things that I was going through would just go away. And, you know, a lot of people find horses very therapeutic. And, you know, and many people, especially non-horse people, don't realize that the bond that you form with the horse and you know, their ability to just help you overcome so many challenges. And that's what Cholo did for me as a young boy.
Is it about trust? I mean, what do you think, at least for you, what is that bond about?
Yeah, no, it's certainly about trust. And one of the, you know, and I talk about this with many people, and one of the things that's really cool, when you're with a horse or around a bunch of horses, you know, they command your attention. You know, you spend all your time just really focusing on that one creature, because for a number of reasons. One, you want to make sure you don't get hurt, and then, you know, you're also, it's just, you know, you have this 1,000-pound beast that's next to you, and it's hard to kind of look away from that. And one of the good things for me, you know, as a kid was, you know, when I was able to leave home and leave, you know, Viola Street and down the bottom, you know, I came to the barn, you know, I was working with Cholo, and that was my time where I disconnected from all of my worries, and I was able to kind of clock out and just really focus on the horse. And ultimately, that just kind of led to an incredible bond between myself and Cholo and all the other horses as well.
You mentioned the fact that this was a really difficult time for you, and I should say that your book, and I'll read it, this book is dedicated to all the victims of gun violence. My late brother David Rosser, and I'm sorry to say Kareem Rosser, he was killed about a year ago in Philadelphia, and I'm sorry about that. And also, this book is dedicated to your dearest friend, a girl named Mecca Harris. She was murdered while a young girl. You were very good friends. You bonded over horses and just sounded like you had a very, very close relationship. What happened to her?
Yeah, no, I mean, Mecca was an incredible young woman who had a bright future. And, you know, unfortunately, one evening, someone decided to break into Mecca's home and execute her father and her mother They all were shot in the head back in October 2003. And, you know, at that time, you know, I was just a young boy. I was just about 10 or so. And, you know, it was my first time ever experiencing true loss, someone who was close to me, and or at least when I was, at least me being aware of it. And, you know, so they were killed, and, you know, it. For, I spent many, many years just, you know, dealing with anxiety because of what happened to Mecca and her family. And, you know, and that was a time when I realized that I was not safe as a kid. You know, right. I would hear about different murders and people shooting and things happening. But it was always an adult, you know, so I didn't at that time didn't think that those sort of things happened to kids or that could happen to me. But when Mecca was murdered, I realized that I was not safe and that, you know, that one day that someone could run into my house and do the same to me and my family.
And they never found the killer, correct?
Yeah, correct. No, they never found the killer. So, you know, even, you know, to this day, that person who murdered them is still out here.
Wow. Frightening. And just as sad. I was just so, frankly, just so heartbroken to read that, to read what happened to her and the effect on you as well. As you say, so many kids growing up in violence deal with trauma on, if not a daily basis, on a regular basis. And as you write, the barn and the horses were a place where you could feel safe, but you started having, I mean, true panic attacks, which are frightening things to have.
Yeah, no, you know, and for very, I guess, I want to say several months after Mecca's death, you know, I thought that I was, you know, I thought I had asthma or was having some sort of issues with my lungs. And, you know, I visited a couple of doctors and, you know, I went through multiple tests to figure out if I was having some sort of respiratory issue. Yeah. But little did I know that I was just suffering from panic attacks. You know, I couldn't sleep at night. You know, every time, you know, before bedtime, I would want to turn the light on and fall asleep with the light on or fall asleep with the TV on just because of I was afraid of the dark and, you know, waiting for someone else to kind of, you know, run through my door or knock my door down and you know, line us up in the basement and execute us. You know, I had all these crazy thoughts as a little boy, and it was all due to the fact that I lost someone so close to me, and you know, someone that I spent nearly every day, you know, my young life with, and you know, and one day she was gone.
And we're talking about this while Philadelphia is in the middle of a terrible. A terrible time with gun violence. Yeah. And oftentimes, she's a young black girl, but oftentimes the victims are young black men.
Yes.
And it's, you know, this is something that continues to this day.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. No, it is. It's sad. And as you noted, you know, we're next week, I think a week from today would make a year for my brother. And we lost my brother, David. You know, he was murdered. He was shot multiple times. Last year on March 12th, and you know, he was killed in the bottom, you know, right where we grew up. And you know, it was, you know, this past year was a difficult year for him, obviously, for many reasons, considering the pandemic that we're dealing with right now. And you know, and for my mom to lose a child, I think it's every parent's worst fear is losing a child. You know, and my mom's been, you know, she's still grieving. And fortunately, you know, there's five, you know, she has five other kids, and, you know, we've all been there for her, and, you know, all we can do is just kind of continue to support her and help her get through this. But, you know, yeah, it's a serious problem in Philadelphia, the gun violence. And, you know, to have known two people, personally, that has been, you know, murder victims, it's incredibly sad.
Yeah, heartbreaking. And it was David, your older brother, who introduced you to this barn and this riding program and to horses.
Yeah, yeah, it was David. You know, David was, you know, he was an incredible person and a very curious person. But he and my brother B both were the first two, and David introduced us to this. That, you know, it ultimately changed our lives, I mean, my life personally, and as well as my brother Damar. But, you know, both David and B decided to take different routes, and, you know, and unfortunately it led to David's death.
Yeah, that's Kareem Rosser, and we're talking about his new memoir just published called Crossing the Line. It's about growing up in West Philadelphia, discovering riding, discovering polo. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. So you eventually begin to play polo. This program introduces you to the sport of polo. Probably could take an hour to describe what polo is all about, but how did you connect with the sport?
Yeah, no. So, you know, I was introduced to polo by Leslie and at Work to Ride. I think the first time I picked up a polo mallet, I was about 10 or so. And, you know, Leslie started her first polo team, I want to say in 99, which was a group of African-American boys. And at that time, you know, they were all terrible riders, and can barely sit on top of a horse. And, you know, then later on, you know, I was introduced to it with my brothers, and, you know, I pick up a mallet and, you know, I went out into our riding ring and started swinging, or at least, you know, tried to swing and tried to hit the ball, but clearly there were several misses on my first attempt. But eventually once I got a swing of it, you know, I just fell in love with it. And, you know, that polo has literally been my passport to the world, and I've been able to travel to some incredible places playing, and I've had a little bit of success as well.
And a passport to a very white world.
Yeah, you know, a very white world, and, you know, myself and my brothers and all the others who are part of the Work to Ride program are the only few faces, you know, people of color, if not the only people of color, really, participating in the sport. Even today, you know, there may be a couple other people, but, you know, it took some time for us to adjust to that, to get used to the fact that, you know, there were no other people who looked like us who participated in the sport. And at times it was intimidating, just because, you know, we didn't look like them, we came from, you know, different backgrounds, both socially and economically. As a young boy, it was intimidating, and it took me some time to get used to, but eventually I figured it out.
I mean, it's not just a white sport, but it's generally, you know, a sport of white wealthy people. So, I mean, you describe going to the Hamptons and, you know, meeting very, you know, the sort of upper class of the country.
Yeah, no, exactly. We spent times in places like the Hamptons and down in Wellington, Florida. Being a kid from West Philly and coming from a place like the Bottom, and, you know, driving up 95 and then driving on LIE, heading into the Hamptons. And then eventually, you know, you hit Southampton or Bridgehampton, and you see these incredible homes, these massive homes. And then we enter into the polo facility there. And, you know, we've never seen a well manicured polo field until we showed up to the Hamptons. We were used to playing in a cow pasture where we learned to play back in New Jersey. That's when we realized that, you know, polo was just a little different than what we thought it was playing back in Philadelphia and in New Jersey. You know, well, it was like, this is real polo. You know, this is what it's like to have a really nice horse and a very nice pair of shiny boots.
Well, your book is called Crossing the Line, which I think is a polo reference. But is it also that reference of that line between West Philadelphia and the Hamptons?
Yeah, absolutely. No, so yeah, so the title definitely has a polo reference, but as well as, you know, again, talking about, you know, leaving the Bottom, going into places like the Hamptons, entering into this unknown world that we know nothing about. You know, we don't fit in at all. We don't talk like anyone that's there. We don't dress like anyone, you know, at these places. And, you know, and we had to kind of figure out how to fit in. And then also the polo reference, you know, and polo is considered probably kind of, I guess some people arguably say that, you know, it's kind of the second most dangerous sport to NASCAR. And, when you're playing at a very high level and you can reach up to speeds close to 25 to 30 miles per hour on a polo pony, and you have to be careful when you're playing. It's a contact sport as well. So there's an invisible line that's created when the ball is struck, and that line has to be respected by both players so that, you know, you avoid any major collision that ultimately sometimes ends up in death for some people.
Wow. You mentioned the fact, and you're right about going to Valley Forge Military Academy, which you hated, at least in the beginning. I mean, I guess it's, you know, when they put you through that whole hazing ritual. But you wanted to leave, but you stayed. What kept you there?
Yeah, no, my time at Valley Forge Military Academy and college was incredible. As I mentioned, my first 2 years, it was quite tough for me just making that transition from the Philadelphia school district to going to a private school, going from a, kind of carefree, show up when you want to show up and there are really no rules in the house to a very strict regimented military schedule. That was very difficult for me. And then I went through a 6 week period where I also didn't have any contact with my family. I want to say nearly 2 years to adjust to it. But my biggest struggle was my academics. I want to say I probably missed nearly 100+ days of school. My sixth or seventh grade year, middle school, where I just did not show up to school.
Yeah.
I showed up to Valley Forge so far behind that it was so frustrating and embarrassing at times for me that where I just wanted to give up. But fortunately, the school just had an incredible staff, and they were able to help me get through some of those dark times and help me, kind of overachieve and overcome, some of my academic struggles. And, I started out as a CD student, working really hard, and eventually ended up graduating, in the top of my class.
Well, there you go. Kareem Rosser, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation talking about his new book, Crossing the Line. And we'll be joined by another polo player after this very short break. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Artie Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I've been talking with Kareem Rosser about his memoir, Crossing the Line, a fearless team of brothers in the sport that changed their lives forever. It's about growing up in West Philadelphia, becoming a star polo player after discovering a barn in Fairmount Park and the Work to Ride program run by Leslie Heiner. Joining us now is Shariah Harris, and she also discovered the program after her mother took a wrong turn driving in Fairmount Park. That similar moment of serendipity led to her passion for riding and polo. She's a Cornell graduate and the first ever African-American woman to play at the highest tier of U.S. polo. She's studying to be a nurse. And Shariah Harris, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And I should say you two know each other, so I don't have to introduce you on the air, correct?
Absolutely.
That's great. Well, thank you for joining us, Shariah. Tell us about the first time as your mom took that wrong turn. I know this is, the story of your life, but what it was like for you to see that barn full of horses.
I was with my younger brother, and the thing that caught us, I think, the most by surprise was that we saw other black kids riding, and that was immediately what made my mom get out of the car and say, okay, let's check this out. And, we walked through the barn, we saw the horses, and of course, we were mesmerized by them. And we actually ran into Leslie, and, we didn't know, her mystique at the time.
Right.
We ran into her, and, my mom inquired about how we could get involved, and she gave us an application for the Work to Ride program.
And we applied,
and that was it.
And that was it. So tell us about your first time on a horse. What was that like for you?
I remember being nervous, but mostly excited. And I'm pretty sure, if my memory is correct, I fell off my first time just trying to get on the horse.
And they're called ponies, but they're horses. I'll go back to you, Shariah. Are we talking about ponies or horses?
We're talking about horses.
Okay.
We refer to them as polo ponies, but they're actually horses.
And for you, Shariah, then I guess like Kareem, and were you two there around the same time in the barn program, Kareem? Were you and Shariah there together or at different times?
Our time sort of overlapped a bit, but I was away at Valley Forge struggling at the time, and then Shariah was at work to ride. So I was still involved. You know, I would come in, I would participate during the weekends at times when I can get away from Valley Forge, as Shariah was, part of the program.
And Shariah, you were playing, again, this is the game of polo, or the sport of polo, that you were playing mostly with boys?
Yes. Yeah, so when I initially started learning how to play, we had a girls team. But, you know, after a year or two, the girls that I played with, you know, either dropped out of the program or got kicked out of the program. So the only other option was for me to play with the boys.
And I read that you are, maybe as a result of that, I don't know, a physical polo player?
I would say so. The
Translation,
boys
please.
Easy on me.
The boys didn't take it easy on you?
No, which I'm grateful for. I think I would have been more offended if they took it easy on me because I was a girl.
You want to talk to that about that, Kareem?
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, Shariah is a very physical player, and, you know, we certainly did not take it easier on her. You know, the barn is just a huge family, so, you know, we were either roasting each other about something or we're out riding on the horse and trying to outdo each other, as we're riding and playing. But, you know, Shariah, she turned out to be an incredible polo player. Clearly she received a scholarship to go to Cornell, where she had some great success there as well. But, yeah, I mean, one of her I guess, greatest attributes is her physical play, for sure.
Yeah. And, Shariah, you talk about discovering this barn and your mother seeing other black children there and feeling like this is a place where you and your brother could feel comfortable and belong. But as I was talking with Kareem Rosser, the world of especially competitive polo is very white and very elite. How did you deal with that?
Yeah, it is a very white elite sport. I do want to add that my older sister joined as well. So
at
some point, she joined about a year later than us, but at some point, all three of us were in the program together.
Oh, that's
but
so cool.
It was definitely unnerving going into spaces that were, you know, mostly white, wealthy families. But we took comfort in knowing that we had each other. You know, our teammates were going through the same uncomfortable feeling. So it wasn't like we were, you know, the only black kid there for the game. We had our teammates. So that definitely brought some comfort to, you know, an otherwise uncomfortable situation sometimes.
Did you have to deal with racist comments or insults or things like that?
At least when I was there, there wasn't anything too overt, because by that time the places were, you know, they were familiar with the Work to Ride kids. But as we started to expand to new places, there were definitely looks that kind of let you know, like, what are you doing here? And I think also because I was a woman in the sport and I was later the captain of the team, it was a double whammy of getting underestimated. They're like, oh, they have a woman captain of the team, this is a weak team.
A black woman on top of that, right?
Exactly.
Kareem, let me go back to you. And this is actually, this is a little digression here, but you had to deal, when you were at Valley Forge Military Academy, you had to deal with someone who called you the N-word. What happened? What did you do? What was the outcome?
That was one unfortunate situation, but, you know, there was just a kid who was bullying many other kids as well, and you know, he decided that, you know, he wanted to pick on me, and you know, that led to him, you know, kind of, you know, basically saying some really, really bad things. And you know, he called me the N-word and many other offensive terms. Mm. But, you know, and you know, that led to me getting upset and punching him in the face. And, you know, then after that led me to a few months of restriction on campus there at Valley Forge. But, you know, after that kid learned his lesson. I think I know he was one of the nicest kids At Valley Forge, you know, after I decided to take matters into my own hands.
Yeah, interesting. So he learned his lesson.
I hope so.
Hopefully.
I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I hope so. I hope he's no longer a bigot and he's, you know, realizing that you can't say those sort of things to people.
Let me go back to you, Shariah. Kareem was talking about this horse Cholo that he had such a connection to and with. Do you have or did you have a horse where you just felt this, that you were sort of one and the same?
Yes, there was a horse that I trained, I think, my senior year of high school. And, you know, there were horses at the barn that we all say that we trained, but this one was fresh off the track. Her name was Katy Perry, but we just called her Katy
for
short.
Oh.
Yes. And, yeah, she was my first horse that I put everything into, and we actually signed her up for the Retired Racehorse Project. And in about a year, I entered her in that contest, and we actually ended up placing third. However, I, unlike Kareem, I decided to sell her. I sold her at the competition, which of course broke my heart, but it was money that I put aside for college. And because I was going away to college, you know, the thoughts were racing through my head. How am I going to see her? What's going to happen to her when I leave? So I decided that was the best decision for her.
Kareem was talking about this trusting relationship with a horse that you feel such a connection to. Do you feel that too, Shariah, when you're riding on a horse that just seems to fit your style, your body, your movements?
Definitely. If you don't make a good connection with a horse, you're not going to be a great rider or a great player. You have to know how to instantly connect with a horse, even if you know that you don't particularly like it. You have to find some connection in order to play well.
How do you do that? If there's a, I won't say difficult horse, but just a horse that you might be struggling with, how do you find that thing?
It honestly comes with a lot of riding experience. Growing up at the barn, we had to deal with all types of problem horses, I'll say. So that definitely gave us a good foundation to go on and basically get on anything and play it.
I want to add to that too as well and say, you know, because many of them, if not all of our horses are donated horses. You know, all the horses that we have at the barn, someone has given to us. And typically when you receive a donation, the horses have some sort of issue or they're just a little older. And, you know, similar, you know, so the horses and the kids that worked right were all kind of quite the same. And since we all had some issue and we all had to kind of figure each other out. But one of the special things is that, you know, you spend time as you're bonding, you know, you're learning, you know, what are these horses, you know, what are the triggers? What makes this horse upset or what calms this horse down? And I think the relationship goes both ways. And as the horse is trying to figure out, you know, what makes, you know, the rider upset and how do I relax the rider? And so there's this, you know, kind of almost dance, if you will, where you're trying to figure each other out. And just as Shariah noted, just through experience, you know, you start learning how to react to horses' personalities in terms of kind of, you know, what upsets them and then what calms them down. And then eventually you find that middle ground and then, you know, you kind of have this sort of this, you know, this incredible relationship that allows you to go out and ride and bond.
And Shariah, what does caring for the horse, you know, brushing them and washing them and cleaning out their hooves, what does that teach you? What does about this relationship?
Honestly, that's the best way to figure out a horse's personality to me. You find out the little weird things that they like, the weird things that they don't like, and all horses have a personality. You can ask anyone who spends a lot of time with horses, you figure out who that horse is. And I think that definitely gives you the blueprint to what you're getting on.
Esther has a question. Do you ride English or Western style? Shariah?
English, but we've done Western as well, but mostly English.
And Kareem, do you prefer one over the other?
It's certainly English because, I mean, polo requires an English saddle and English riding. So we spent pretty much all of our time riding the English saddle. But it is nice to sit in the Western saddle and relax sometimes when we get an opportunity to do that.
Kind of like a motorcycle. You sit back right in that big old Western saddle.
Exactly.
Cletus wants to know, he says, I've ridden my whole life. Have your guests ever played polo in Revere, Pennsylvania? Shariah?
I have not.
Kareem?
No, I have not. I'm wondering where that is, actually.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, we'll have to ask him. Because, I mean, I think we've played in pretty much all the clubs, all the polo clubs in PA.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Maybe he's referencing a club that's nearby. We just didn't know that's the name of the area.
Got it. And Shreya, and this is for you, Kareem, as well, which is polo has really taken you all over the world. Where have you been, Shreya, playing polo?
Yes, it's taken me to Nigeria. I've played in England and as well as Argentina.
And you're studying nursing?
Yes, I am. I'm in a 2-year nursing program right now.
And what kind of nursing do you want to do? What's your ambition?
Right now, I would like to be in the ER because I play polo, so I'm an adrenaline junkie. So right now, that's where I plan on being. But once I start my clinical rotations, that could change. But something that's going to be exciting.
Something exciting. And Kareem, you work in the world of finance.
Yes. Yep. So I've been spending my last 4 years working in an asset management firm here in Philly, which has been incredible. But at the same time, has allowed me to use some of my finance skills to help, raise money for Work to Ride. You know, we are in the middle of a capital campaign to build a new indoor riding facility here in Philadelphia and refurbish our current facility that we have here that we lease from the city, and then seed an endowment that will allow us to help with future operations and sustain the organization long-term.
And Shreya, how often do you get to go horseback riding?
It's
been a long and cold winter, I should add, but nonetheless, and of course the pandemic, but...
It definitely has. I don't get out as much as I would like to because of school and work, but at least once or twice a month.
And when you're riding on that back of the horse, you just feel sort of at one with the world?
Definitely. I feel like I'm back home, riding with the kids, riding back in the old arena. Even if it's cold out, it still is a good feeling.
And Kareem, you were a stunt double for Idris Elba, correct?
Yeah, that was about 2 summers ago. I was fortunately enough to be asked to double the sexiest man alive. I guess one of the. No.
I was going to say that, but I'm glad you did. Yes.
No, just joking. It was really cool because it was filmed in here in North Philadelphia. It was based on a book called Ghetto Cowboy, written by Greg Neri. Great book. And what I was really excited about in being part of that project was they involved a lot of the local Philadelphia cowboys, and they were also acting and part of the movie. And I was fortunate enough to watch the film maybe a week ago or so, and it's an incredible film. But it was a really neat experience, kind of doubling and doing all the stunt work. It was easy because it was just me riding what I do best and what I know well.
Yeah.
But I also learned that I did not want to become an actor because I did not enjoy sitting around for 12 hours or 13 hours a day.
for your 1 minute of film time, right?
Yeah, exactly. But it was a really neat experience, and then the film, just to be involved in something like that and also, do it in our hometown and do it with folks that we know, it was exciting.
Yeah. Well, it's been such a pleasure, such a treat to talk to both of you. Kareem Rosser, thank you for joining us. Thank you for writing your book as well.
No, thank you, Marty. We appreciate you. And thank you for having me today and allowing us to share our story and talk about, the incredible program.
And the program is called Work to Ride, run by Leslie Heiner. It's in Fairmount Park in Philadelphia. And Kareem Rosser's book is called Crossing the Line. And Shreya Harris, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
No, of course. Thank you for having us here.
You're very welcome. And she is studying to be a nurse. And both of them have been star polo players. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.